It's just gone 7 o'clock on your Sunday evening. A big hello and welcome back to the MK Mental Health Hour with me, Leah, on MKFM. We do this on the first Sunday of every month. And as always, we are joined in the studio by John Manning from Arthur Ellis Mental Health Support. Hello, John.
Hello, good evening.
Hello, good evening. Lovely to have you with us today.
Lovely to be here as always.
So we always do a Mental Health Hour on the first Sunday of the month. And we basically dedicate the show to a mental health topic. And we have an expert that comes in, Amy Langford, who is the Group Director of Inclusion at Milton Keynes College Group, is going to be joining us this evening. Before we get into the show, John, tell us all about Arthur Ellis Mental Health Support and everything that you guys do.
So Arthur Ellis is a business, first and foremost. We work with corporates that enable us to subsidise our charity arm, which is operating a one-to-one service for the people of Milton Keynes and broader areas. So we partner with GP surgeries, schools, other charities in order to enable people to access one-to-one support without waiting lists or without thresholds.
Fantastic. You do such amazing work. You're always super, super busy as well. I think one of the last times you came in, you were saying that your website's all been updated and everything. Is it all going smoothly?
It's getting there around about now. So we are digitising our referral process. So that just enables people to go onto our website, go through a quick, simple referral process, choose their mentor, one of the members of the team that can support them, and then also start to book their appointments quite independently. So it puts all of the control and the power into the individual's hands. We don't want to just say to people, this is your appointment, like it or lump it. We want people to have the choice, have the options. So we've
it's
gone through
refreshing,
a,
isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
we've not gone like, through a big digital yeah. transformation process, and you can imagine it might sound like a simple thing to do, but with data protection and all of these things going into it, it's taken quite a while, so it's a really exciting time.
Oh, well, well done to you and the team. Very, very exciting time. And you are always super busy. What have you got kind of coming up over this summer?
Yeah, well, last summer we did a trial of a summer festival, but we're bringing it to the people of Milton Keynes this year.
Love that.
So we really want, firstly, we want the public to get behind it because it's not an easy feat to pull off. But also businesses who may want to sponsor the event or even organisations that provide something that's really good for people's well-being. I'd love for there to be a network of organisations who turn up who can provide things that get people moving, that enable people to access art or drawing or writing. So anyone that does anything related to well-being that think they could help us, please reach out, because we would love to get loads of organisations showcased at this event.
Brilliant. And if people do want to reach out to you, is the best place to go onto your website?
Yeah, well, we're looking to host the event in July sort of time. We're still looking at specific dates, but if people head over to www.arthurellismhs.com, they can reach out to us and we can chat about it.
Brilliant. Well, please do that if you can help at all. The summer party was a great success last year, so hopefully bigger and better this year. Absolutely. So tell us a little bit about what we're talking about tonight, John.
Yes, so we're talking about young people and their mental health in Milton Keynes. So specifically the things that are influencing them. So Amy at the college, we've worked with the college now for a number of years, supporting some of the most vulnerable students and also supporting staff with safeguarding and that sort of thing to make sure the colleges are safe, happy place. And there's a lot that young people are facing that is influencing their mental health. So not specifically talking about their mental health, but generally the things that are challenging them. So we thought it would be a good opportunity to bring Amy on, talk about those things and see what the college are doing about it and what broader society can do about them as well.
Absolutely. And welcome, Amy. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks. Great to be here.
It's lovely to have you with us. So tell us a little bit more about you, Amy, and your role at the college.
Okay, so I'm Group Director of Inclusion at the college. And essentially that means I oversee all of the support services. So anything we're doing to make sure that young people and adults can engage effectively with their learning and their courses. And as John said, there's quite a few different things we've been doing over the last couple of years to ensure that that's as meaningful as possible. Because as you can imagine, young people particularly face a degree of hardship. We take young people from some of the most deprived wards in Milton Keynes. So again, it's looking at how we can work with them so they can be successful in their journey with us.
Brilliant. Well, a very vital role that you play. So we're going to be talking all about young people's mental health in Milton Keynes this evening, and we're going to dive into that next. So this evening on the MK Mental Health Hour, I'm joined as always by John Manning from Arthur Ellis Mental Health Support and Amy Langford, who is Group Director of Inclusion at Milton Keynes College Group. And tonight we are talking all about young people's mental health in Milton Keynes. So you were just saying off air, John, that you've kind of identified kind of three areas that this might fall into.
Yes, yeah, and Arthur Ellis have been quite involved with Vital Signs this year. If anyone doesn't know what that is, it's Milton Keynes Community Foundation put together loads of research about what's impacting the city, not necessarily just young people, but some of the key trends that have come out of that that we wanted to address and talk about is that when you're in an educational setting or there's a big group of young people around, there are a few things that are notorious for impacting them. So one of those is antisocial behaviour. One of them is social media, and the last one is communication. And that's not a finite list. There's much broader things than that, but we wanted to tackle at least discussing these subjects in this show.
So the first one that we're going to look at then is antisocial behaviour. So I suppose we're going to be looking at the links with antisocial behaviour and mental health for young people in Milton Keynes.
Yeah.
So what are the links? How is that all kind of connected?
So there's a couple of things that people like to do, and this is across the board with mental health, and that's avoid. One of the things, and the reason why Amy from the college is here, is that the college have chosen to really not avoid some of the issues that young people face with antisocial behaviour, like knife crime, for example. Generally speaking, only 1% of a population of young people will ever have carried a weapon. But the college have taken that and not necessarily wanted to avoid the topic, but they've brought in measures. And when it comes to mental health, when measures are brought in, what we tend to see is that self-awareness rises. So people become aware of these things. It's kind of like on your doorstep or it's in your face. And even though self-awareness rising is a good thing, what we do see initially is that anxiety and depression also rise.
Oh, right.
So when people go through our one-to-one service, and if someone's got low self-awareness and we want to raise it, we'll see that their anxiety and depression also go up, which seemingly is a bad thing. Like, why have you gone through a one-to-one service and now you're more anxious and depressed?
Yeah.
But that's prior to those tools and resources being put in and somebody starting to use them. So it's kind of like the first step.
Right, okay. And tell us about the MK College Group and what it is that you're doing towards antisocial behaviour.
Sure. So as John has said, I mean, if we're thinking about education and how you engage meaningfully with that, you need to think about the kind of the hygiene factors first and people's ability to feel safe. So again, as John says, if we're thinking about the things that can impact young people, particularly in being able to engage, their feeling of safety, personal safety, and what that means to them is very important.
Mm.
And so as John has said, as we know from statistics, only 1% of young people are likely to have a carry a weapon. However, the perception can be that far more people are engaging in what we would class as antisocial behaviour or gang-related activity. So for us to be able to, again, meaningfully interact with young people about this, we have to call it out and we have to be quite bold in doing so. So one of the things that we have introduced is screening arches. So you'll find in London colleges or in Manchester and more densely populated areas that this is commonplace, but in Milton Keynes it isn't. So what we have done, as I say, is be very proactive in saying we are aware that for young people this is a concern, potentially, that they may be concerned about their own safety, safety of their peers. And so actually we are going to very visibly tackle this, and we're going to implement screening arches. So they are randomly operated, and we will expect, but not, it's not mandated that you have to go through it.
It's not enforced.
No, we're not enforcing, no. So it's a screening. So we're asking young people randomly to walk through the arches, and if they were to be carrying anything that we would consider to be an offensive weapon, we would manage that situation. Now, what it has done is enabled us to have really deep conversations with our young people and talk about the whys and wherefores. So as John has said, when we first introduced this, and we did this in consultation with parents and the young people and other stakeholders, of course the anxiety is going to, in the first instance, go up because there'll be a sense that this is needed because there's an issue. And the reality is there is an issue across the country, across Milton Keynes, across everywhere, not particularly within the college. However, it gives us the platform to be having the conversations, as I say. And what we have found is 86% of our students saying they feel safer as a result of this.
Brilliant.
And safety, integral to positive wellbeing, mental health and all of those things. So it's something that we've been trialling, and now we're rolling it out more. We have more arches and we're doing it more often.
Because it would have been, so we're in March now, so when was it introduced? Because I know we spoke, because we're one of the stakeholders that you're involved in the decision-making. Yeah, yeah. So
September, October time?
So 6 months. Yeah. 5, 6 months. So really, that sort of shows that initially there's going to be a rise in anxiety. People are more self-aware of it. They're going to think that, you know, they're everywhere. But actually, if you stick with it, and like you said about being proactive, I think that's a great word to use. If you stick with it and you explain it and have those conversations, rather than just plonking it there and let's never talk about it again, just shut up and get on with it. If you actually engage people in those conversations, anxiety is the fear of the unknown. So every conversation that you have, that unknown element diminishes a bit. Yeah,
absolutely. So, and like you say, it's that proactive nature and having those deep conversations with people. We're based here at Stadium MK, and obviously last year we had the Knife Angel that came here,
of course.
And it was really fascinating to see the amount of people that were coming and having these conversations with people, and saying that, you know, these knives were actually used in, you know, in crimes and things like that. And it's just having those open and honest conversations and being very proactive. So really fascinating, and then seeing the impact on people's mental health as well.
Yeah, and I think one of the key things is, again, it can be very easy when you have a subject that is a bit taboo or controversial, and equally, you know, as John and I will both have seen, historically mental health has been just that. People haven't wanted to talk about it. So it's about tackling those things that are impacting us, and if we ignore them, that's only going to get worse. So we've been able to engage with young people and parents, and parents actually have been very, they've had real positive feedback on it as well, because it is enabling us to really just get involved in ways that otherwise, if you're in a classroom talking about knife crime or any antisocial behaviour, it's quite one-dimensional and you don't necessarily get the buy-in. But when you're actually stood there having the conversations, talking about why it's important and why our own personal safety is so important, and actually your only option isn't to carry a weapon, it's to engage with people. So we have Safer MK involved and other people as well. And yeah, I think it's important across the spectrum to be talking about things that that traditionally and typically young people don't really want to talk about.
And if you were to find one, having the conversations as to why you carrying one, and understanding really where that stems from, because a lot of it isn't necessarily a real life threat, because a lot of conversations don't happen in the classroom anymore. They happen online, or they happen with social media. So really, that sort of brings us to our next challenge of social media for young people, that a lot of these things that are being discussed aren't out in the open. So if we can start to have these things that enable us to bring out in the open, then it can only do good.
Absolutely. And that was a perfect segue into our next talk topic, which is going to be all about social media, which we'll discuss next. So this evening on the MK Mental Health Hour, we're talking all about young people's mental health in Milton Keynes, as always joined by John Manning from Arthur Ellis Mental Health Support and Amy Langford, who is Group Director of Inclusion at Milton Keynes College Group. So we're talking about the different influences of young people's mental health in Milton Keynes. Yeah. And we've kind of divided the show this evening into kind of three sections, haven't we, John?
Yeah, there's so much information to go through, and there's so many things that influence young people. So we wanted to split it down a little bit just so we can discussions around each. So we've talked about antisocial behaviour. The next thing we wanted to talk about was social media, and then finally communication.
Brilliant. So social media, obviously a massive topic for everybody, but particularly for young people in Milton Keynes. So how is social media affecting their mental health?
Oh, so many ways. Yeah. I've got a bit of a social media is a bit of a bone of contention for me, because it's one of those things that's required now, but not helpful. And there's a variety of ways that, you know, one of our specific elements of well-being is move, for example. So when you're sat on social media, are you moving?
No, probably
so
not.
It limits the amount of exercise. You know, same with gaming and those sorts of things. They are great for us. They make us feel better. They release dopamine, which is our reward hormone. It makes us feel better. But we're not doing some of the fundamental things that we need to as humans. Equally, it changes the way that we communicate, which we can get to a little bit more in the next part of the show. But there's other ways in which it does, which in the methods in which we're using to communicate are herd-like. There's something called a psychological contagion, which means that if one person has a thought in a group of people, that thought can carry itself throughout the group.
Right, so you see everybody kind of jumping on the bandwagon of something.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And it's, in theory, it's called a psychological contagion, where it kind of spreads. And we've had COVID, people understand how these things spread.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily an illness as such, but it does operate in a very similar way. So there's all of these different thoughts, feelings, even negative coping strategies that can spread by sharing things on social media.
And have you noticed that, Amy, through Milton Keynes College? Have you seen that with students and young people, how social media is affecting their mental health?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think one of the biggest things for us, it's the power of that voice that's distant from your own psyche, if you like, but actually is having more power than your own internal voice, if that makes sense.
Right.
So we're seeing young people who are being influenced by what they're seeing on TikTok, Instagram, Snapchat, et cetera, et cetera. But they're not sense-checking any of it. They're taking it, they're absorbing it all, and they're not filtering it. They're not really asking the questions that we would do if John said something to me now, or if you said something to me now, I'd be thinking, oh, what, you know, what's your agenda there, or what have you. So they're just assimilating it all and then acting in certain ways as a result of that. So that is problematic. And ultimately, if we're thinking by the time young people reach further education, so 16 to 19 is our most significant cohort, they've been operating these ways for so many years, it's very difficult to unpick that. Mm. And for some young people, not all, but this is the most dominant voice they have. They may be living in households where they're not interacting with parents or siblings, or particularly with their peers in a physical way. Mm. They're on their phones or their laptops or their tablets or what have you. And again, it can be difficult to then get into that and unpick it. And that's why the work that John does is so important, and other services around as well. So as a college, we are constantly encouraging young people to, yes, engage with this, because you have to. It's part of everyday life.
Yeah.
But it's how you do that you've got to be proportionate in the amount of credibility you're giving to any of these things. And for them, again, if they've been doing it since they were 6, 7 years old, mm. it's so common to them,
yeah.
mm. that it is a struggle for us. And again, what we've seen is the impact. So someone's, from a safeguarding point of view, you look at whether someone's behaving typically for them, and if there's something out of the ordinary, and that could potentially be a sign that something is going on. And we are seeing young people who are behaving very out of character because of the influences that they have on Snapchat, Instagram, TikTok, whatever. So for us, it is a big challenge, as it is for all educational organisations.
I mean, I remember being at school and you had this kind of keeping up with the Joneses, and you had those social pressures anyway. Mm-hmm. So I can imagine now this added pressure of social media, of people not just within your college or within your school, you've got all of these external influences on social media that is just a huge, huge impact, and yeah. such a, you know, must make such a difference on people's mental health and dealing with day-to-day things. So again, it's good to be able to have these conversations, like we were talking earlier about antisocial behaviour, because they are really, really important conversations. And actually, like we were saying about that affects how people communicate as well, which is actually what we're going to be talking about next.
Yeah, and social media never switches off.
No.
Either. So it's kind
constant.
Of like, yeah, you know, when we were in the playground, it's like just constantly being in the playground and that bickering and all of that sort of stuff, and it doesn't end. We've seen some students, not necessarily of the college, but we've done groups with young people in Milton Keynes, and there's also been these challenges of how much screen time can you get, and I've seen the screen time on some young people's phone, which is 18-19 hours.
What a challenge for it to be higher.
Yeah, to be as high as possible. And these are parents as well who have limited, they've done all of the things that they should have done, you know, limited Wi-Fi, stopped the phone contracts having 5G or 4G or mobile data, all of these things, but they are finding ways to access it. And we really need to acknowledge that smartphones are an addiction. They are built to be addictive. So the three little dots on your phone when someone's messaging back, or the typing dot 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 on WhatsApp, that's a dopamine trigger designed so that you don't put your phone down, so that you wait for that message to come back. That's a reward, like, oh, thank you very much, you're replying to me. That's why people get so annoyed when they get left on red, because it's like, you've stolen my dopamine. How dare you. But if we think about in the context of your age group at further education, 19 years old, social media was released in about 2007 or so. Over the next 3 years, we saw a spike in young people being hospitalised by about 180%.
Gosh.
So this sharing of coping strategies, negativity, is having a real impact on them. And now, if we assume that students or young people are getting phones when they're in sort of secondary school, you're talking now that 19-year-olds won't know life without social media.
Gosh, that
26-year-olds or so won't know life without smartphones. So dial-up internet, with that tone that we used to hear all the time, or, you know, if someone was using the phone, you can't use the computer, and those trade-offs, that wouldn't have existed for people from 26 and below?
I think one of the big problems we find is that it's how they get their status and their self-esteem is by the amount of, it's not likes anymore, I'm very outdated, but the amount of attention they're receiving, or the amount of Snapchat's one of the big ones for us in terms of how many snaps you can get and how quickly people are responding. So then equally, people can be on a high 1 minute and then they dip right down, and they will then do whatever they deem is necessary to get back up again. So they will behave in ways that perhaps they wouldn't normally to try and get that attention.
Right. It's activity over outcomes. Mm-hmm. Rather than doing something good or doing something that has a lasting impact, it's doing something for the moment that gets your activity up.
Gosh, and then it doesn't last very long and then you need to do it again, and that's where you kind of get that cycle.
You up the game every single time.
Yeah.
When dopamine is released, it's, if you imagine a tap opening up into a bathtub, rather than the bathtub overflowing of dopamine, the bathtub just expands in our brains. So when it drains out, it never retracts. Dopamine is, that's why it's addictive.
Oh, right.
So if somebody does a skydive, for example, the next time they're going to have to go higher in the plane. And that's kind of what happens with things like social media or even drugs and alcohol and these sorts of things. And that's where addiction can be spurred on.
Well,
it's really important to try our best in whatever way we can to limit that exposure.
Absolutely. And really important that we have these conversations.
Yeah,
so we're
going
to continue the discussion, and we're going to be talking about communication and the effects on young people's mental health in Milton Keynes next. So we were just talking about the impact of social media on young people's mental health in Milton Keynes, John, and I guess that has a direct kind of impact on their communication skills as well.
Yeah, well, social skills is one of the key elements of our well-being. It's one of the five areas, is our ability to communicate, not necessarily just communicating how we're feeling or communicating what we need, but communicating in general. It builds and maintains really strong relationships around us. It gives us an identity, a sense of belonging, all of that. It brings a group around us, which can be really, really helpful. If we have strong relationships with people, we're more likely to talk about what's bothering us anyway. So if we think about social media and the methods of communication, or even smartphones and the method of communication that's used, if we break it down into two particular elements, so we've got verbal communication, which is just the words that we say, and then we've got non-verbal, which would be our eye contact, hand gestures — I'm doing a bunch of that now — body language. You know, I could use a hand gesture to you, Leah, and you will know exactly what I mean without me saying a word.
Yeah,
I'm not going to.
No, thanks.
But yeah, people who have had a bit of road rage before will know what I mean. We can do all sorts with our bodies that can inform people about how we're feeling. So the ability to pick up on those social cues, recognize how someone feels when they walk in the room without mentioning anything, that's one of the things that COVID did, is it made us all lock in our homes, so we're not going to see all of these social cues or pick up on these non-verbal methods of communication. So when we are communicating, about 7% of our skill we're using verbally. About 93% of our communication skill is non-verbal, that body language and stuff. So if there are young people or older people, whoever, who are really relying on their devices to communicate, they're only really accessing about 7% of their ability to communicate.
And I suppose we've all been there, where you've maybe received a text message from someone, or you've read something on social media and you've totally interpreted it in the wrong way.
And then you're sleeping on the sofa.
Exactly. So that is really, really important to have kind of that full communication skills.
Yeah, absolutely.
Amy, how do you see young people communicating these days?
Well, I think it's really interesting. Again, we were talking earlier off air about the differences between different age groups as well, and how they are associating with whether it's social media or each other. I think one of the big challenges around communication for us is, because of the way that social media and communication operates, there is the real risk that people can just disappear from their lives. So they can be in conversation with them and then that person is gone. And it may be that they never actually met this person, or it may be someone they're friends with. But this fear of that communication breakdown leads sometimes to young people, particularly working with adults, to just not communicate at all for risk of it disappearing from them.
Right.
So we are seeing...
It goes back to that avoidance, I suppose.
Yeah, like, of course.
If I don't talk to anyone in the first place, I can't be...
Yeah, it can't be
let
away
down.
From me. That's it. So it's about building trust between the people working with young people and between themselves, actually, and developing those relationships again. Because as John says, I think COVID brought with it a whole range of challenges, but this is one that we're definitely seeing, that the ability to actually communicate, I think I used the word earlier, meaningfully in a way that's actually tangible and has an impact, is so important. But we potentially, as a society, don't do enough of that face-to-face conversation. So, yeah, it is a huge challenge for us. And again, it's that sense that social media communication is the most important thing. And actually, when we're talking about working with young people and trying to get them to see the value in open communication face-to-face, it's them having belief in that. And it's much more difficult to say something challenging or, you know, risky face-to-face, because you could be instantly just rebuffed, or you could feel silly. And so they're much braver over their phones or their tablets, and they will say the most outlandish things, and that's not appropriate either. So it's getting that balance. But certainly in all the work I do, a lot of the things I do around behaviours, positive behaviours and well-being, resilience and those things, and it takes a lot of work to, again, unpick and get to the root of what's going on, and for them to be able to articulate that in a face-to-face way. Texting, they may well be able to do that, but not actually having those kind of more visceral interactions with people.
So it is really important to start teaching and understanding why people are just texting, but also encouraging them to see the value in having face-to-face conversations.
Definitely. And I think, again, we've had conversations, I'm sure John will speak about it in a minute, but it's about not diminishing the opportunities to do that. So when we're trying to communicate with young people about what their needs might be from a SEND point of view, a mental health point of view, we do use forms on Microsoft Forms or what have you for them to give us the information. We do stuff online, digitally, so over Zoom or Teams or what have you, but we also need them to be coming in and actually talking to us, because if we're enabling them to just have that one form of communication, then they will never develop those skills that they're going to need.
Yeah, they're going to need it. And I did see a few months ago that the government are really struggling to reach out to people for jobs and that sort of thing, because young people just aren't answering the phone because they don't really need to. They haven't necessarily done it before. It's a big, daunting thing. So instead of the government, I really disagree with any changes to moving towards more text services or anything like that, because they are going to lose those skills. We need to actually start training young people. Education needs to change. The curriculum needs to change in order to teach people those communication skills. How do you answer the phone? How do you introduce yourself? How do you rock up at an office and ask for a job? You know, be assertive.
They're all really important skills, aren't they?
Really
to
important.
Know how to handle yourself, and actually that does become part of your identity as well, doesn't it? We were talking about identity earlier, and actually if you can walk into a room or an office and you can present yourself and introduce yourself and ask for a job, then that speaks volumes rather than just filling out an online application form, or, you know, doing it all online and digitally.
And I remember when I was younger, I would maybe do something wrong to a neighbour or whatever, and my mum would march me around there on the doorstep to apologise face to face. Now we've got a block button and we don't necessarily have to do anything about it. And to add to what you were saying, Amy, earlier on, is that it was really, you know, people are braver on their devices. Mental health is generally assessed by what impact it's having to your day-to-day activities. So is something impacting you to the point where you're not going out anymore, or not going to the shops, or not talking to somebody? So if you are really brave on your device and you've said a bunch of stuff that maybe you wouldn't in person, you're less likely to then go to college because you want to avoid that person that you said it to, or go into the workplace or whatever it might be, go to the pub or a club or whatever when you know someone's going to be there. So the way that we're beginning to behave is actually enabling mental health issues by impacting what we do day to day.
Right. So it is so important to continue having these conversations and making sure we're doing the right thing.
And teaching our young people how to converse in this way and to tackle and encourage them to tackle those difficult situations. Obviously, you can facilitate it. They don't have to go alone, you know, but it's important to not avoid them.
Absolutely. So we've kind of split the show this evening into antisocial behaviour, social media, communication. We're now going to kind of look at those and see what needs to be done to help those issues, because I feel like there's been a, I mean, we've spoken about the facts and what's actually going on, but now it's about how we can help those situations and kind of give some tools and techniques. So we'll be diving into that next. So this evening on the MK Mental Health Hour, we're talking all about young people's mental health in Milton Keynes. As always, we're joined by John Manning from Arthur Ellis Mental Health Support and Amy Langford, who is Group Director of Inclusion at Milton Keynes College Group. So there is, it's such a huge topic, young people's mental health, and we've kind of devised the show this evening into three sections. We've spoken about antisocial behaviour, social media and communication. And Amy's been here talking about the perspective of Milton Keynes College Group and how proactive you've been and having these kind of deep conversations. But what we're now about to go into is what needs to be done to help some of these issues. And ultimately, it can't be down to just one institution, can it?
No, indeed. So I think a lot of what we talked about, when you actually boil it down, it's around the individual sense of self and their self-esteem and their identity and belonging. So again, there's an awful lot that as a college we can do independently. However, there's a lot more power when it's people coming together, be that primary schools, secondary schools and colleges, be that educators and parents, be that mental health services and education. So it's about how we all are working together for a common shared goal.
It's kind of like us as a mental health service, we individually cannot solve all of the mental health crises or issues across the country for all young people. We have to work together as mental health services. You know, it's colleges getting together or education institutes getting together, parents getting together. So we have to start collaborating a lot more in order to tackle some of these issues. It's not going to be done in a silo, and it needs to be done an awful lot earlier. Yeah. So I would suggest working a lot more preventatively. The college, I know that we've spoken before about how it's almost firefighting when young people get to the stage of being in college. I don't know whether you would...
Yeah, I think, again, if we're talking about college, that's a microcosm, isn't it? We have currently in the region 3,000 16 to 19-year-olds within the college across the campuses, and they potentially can be with us for as short a period of time as 9 months, really, when you boil it all down in terms of breaks and things like that. So that's a very short space of time, and we're trying to pack in so much. So, yeah, it's about us having capacity building and making sure that we're working alongside other services.
It's really important to mention that what we're talking about here today is just the challenges that they face outside of what they're actually at the college to learn. Like they're doing a course alongside all of these other issues. So really, if you think about the actual time to intervene, that's why we're suggesting that it starts an awful lot earlier. Not to say that, you know, once someone gets to further education, they're written off at all. But the intervention needs to be slightly different. It needs to be a little bit more impactful, a bit more in your face. But if we can get in a lot earlier, so help, you know, parents, supporting parents to put some rules and boundaries in place around screen time, for example, that can be a really small, quite simple step that can be put in place. But we've spoken to loads of parents and the challenges that parents face with cost of living as well. Both parents, if there are both parents present in the home, have to work in order to run a household. So that means that you need additional tools in order to occupy your young people. So screens are a really handy tool for that, because childcare is super expensive. And it becomes kind of like a chicken and egg kind of thing, if you know what
it's
I mean.
It's where you're saying that actually all of these different organisations and people need to come together to work you know, the greater good of what the outcome is going
to
be.
Yeah, there should be enough funding for us to operate a really good wellbeing network across the city. That's enough things for families to do at the weekends, in evenings, outside of school time, even during school time for young kids that aren't in school yet or nurseries, that enable wellbeing activities like swimming classes or groups. They could be funded. So there's active things that people can do. There's also drawing, art classes, really fun educational things that don't involve screens that young people can get involved in from pretty much birth all the way up throughout their years. And because there are screens that are embedded in their lives, like I said about the dopamine, you know, as soon as you have that hit, nothing else is really going to compare. So as soon as you have that exposure, it's a lot more difficult to get them involved in that, because they're, oh, that's boring. Like, that's not going to give me the same hit. So if we can start teaching young people that these things are amazing and they are really good for us and they help us, that's the first step to be able to start being a bit more preventative and tackle it at the root source.
I think the other thing is as well, it's really we're on a bit of a knife edge, for want of a better phrase, that we have to avoid a blame culture as well. So I'm a parent myself, and I appreciate that for my 11 and 15 year olds, screens are a big part of their lives, and they're using it for education as well. So they're using them in schools. So it's about not scaremongering parents and not making them reflect on their own practice and think, oh, you know, I'm doing a bad job, because all that's going to happen then is their barriers are going to go up as well.
Yeah.
So it's, again, I think for me, parents is a big one, because by the time they reach us, again, they're 16 to 19. However, parents in a lot of cases will still have some influence, but they potentially they don't understand it, because I don't want to, you know, be critical in any way, because I would count myself amongst this number, but they don't necessarily appreciate the negative impact that some of these things can have.
Yeah, and that's what I mean about the cost of living, the need for multiple parents, or for a single parent to work an awful lot. It's the system that's almost enabling this culture of, you know, having screens and that sort of thing. So we need to readdress where funding is being put in order to enable people to access wellbeing.
And as always, a really, really fascinating conversation with John Manning from Arthur Ellis Mental Health Support and Amy Langford, talking all about young people's mental health in Milton Keynes. Some really helpful things and tools that we were just discussing there. And we're going to give a bit of a summary for you next. So this evening on the MK Mental Health Hour, we've been talking all about young people's mental health in Milton Keynes. As always, so much information to digest, and I do not envy you doing this job, John, because now you're going to try and summarise everything that we've run through this evening beautifully.
Try to.
Over to
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. So one of the key messages out of this, particularly in the early part of the discussion around antisocial behaviour, is not to avoid these topics. It's so easy to do, and we really don't want to put our heads in the sand, avoid things. It's a very, very short-term strategy, and it very rarely ends well. So the college have been amazing at being proactive around this stuff, particularly around knife crime and getting screening arches in place. When we do see these things, or this put in front of our faces like this, our self-awareness will raise, and also we will anticipate that anxiety and depression will potentially rise as well along with it. But that's just because we are now more aware. By having deep conversations about it, it's going to lower our levels of anxiety because we become more knowledgeable about the subject. So research, talk about it, have deep conversations, but it's very important for those conversations to be face to face. Social media is enabling us to communicate solely verbally, which only accesses around 7% of our social skills. If we can access and tap into the 93%, which is our hand gestures, body language, eye contact, tone of voice, whatever else it might be, that's going to enable us to have much deeper relationships, deeper conversations, access an awful lot more of our social skills so that we can build a community around ourselves. We're much more likely to talk about the things that are bothering us and help us to spread out our stress a little bit more. And finally, in way of intervening and becoming a bit more preventative with these things so that they start to have an impact on broader society, it takes a village. It's not just going to be one institution, one group of people, or one family doing this. There are things that you can start implementing, like really measuring screen time, enabling those conversations. So one thing I would suggest is have dinner around the dinner table, turn off the telly, have conversations with your family, and if you can, start to try and limit screen time a little bit so that you're enabling that communication more.
And I suppose that will tick off quite a few boxes, because you're limiting the screen time, but you're also having more conversations.
Absolutely,
and hopefully they can dive into a few more of these topics.
It's not necessarily our job to teach children how to be children. They already know because they're doing it. It's our job to teach them how to be adults. So if we can start to encourage young people to act like adults a little bit sooner by having those deep conversations around them and teaching them how to converse effectively, that's only going to help them. Obviously, be age appropriate with what you're talking about, but those methods of communication are only going to hold them in good stead.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, John. It's been so, so fascinating having you on the show, as always. If people want to find out more information about you and Arthur Ellis Mental Health Support, how can they do that?
Absolutely. And from a parenting point of view, accessing more things that are going to be great for people's well-being, go out to the parks. There's so many in Milton Keynes. In Arthur Ellis, we're looking to engage in a lot more of these activities and actually run and operate some of these activities.
Brilliant.
So Not sure at the time that this is released that it will be. Bear with me.
Just keep an eye on your website.
If you want to help, by all means, get in touch with us. It's arthurellismhs.com.
Brilliant, brilliant. And like you say, Milton Keynes, we've got so many fantastic green spaces
so
and things like that.
It's amazing.
Absolutely. And Amy Langford, who is Group Director of Inclusion at Milton Keynes College Group, thank you so much for your time as well. It's been fascinating hearing from you. If people want to find out more about MK College, how can they do that?
So you can come and have a look at our website, which is mkcollege.ac.uk. We do have an open event coming up on Tuesday the 7th of May. What I would like to say is that we are, you know, Milton Keynes is unique, we all know that, but I think it's safe to say there's such passion across the city in terms of all of the organisations working together, and from a local authority point of view, that we are all committed to making improvements. The college's strapline is building fairer futures. So again, we've got a lot of resources on the website for you to have a look at, but in terms of further education, come along, have conversations, have a look. And yeah, thank you for having me on the show.
Brilliant. And you have an open day coming up in May as well, don't you?
Yeah.
Lovely. And I know we'll have some of the details over on our website as well at mkfm.com. Thank you both so much. And thank you very much for joining us for another MK Mental Health Hour. If you did miss anything in the show, it will all be podcast over on our website, as I said, mkfm.com. And we will see you for another MK Mental Health Hour on the first Sunday of next month.